Na, 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 na.
And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU-FM. Just like I was saying before the break, we have a double featured program today. First, we're speaking with Phil Taylor from the Taylor Report about an issue with prisons that we don't talk about very much. And then following from that, we're going to be talking about North Korea, South Korea, United States, Japan, and Canada. We're going to be going into that a bit later in the program. But first, I think we should have Phil Taylor on the line with us. Phil, are you here with us?
Yes.
Wonderful. I can hear you. Well, great. Well, thanks for being with us today.
Sure.
Well, I understand. I mean, you've been keeping track of a number of issues, one of which is an individual, a man, I believe, of Yugoslav or Serbian origin who has been put on trial or imprisoned by the United Nations for some time now, and there's a second individual as well. What caught your interest about them in prison and the whole process that was involved?
Well, it's a overarching issue, and it should be of interest to your listeners and all Canadians, everybody concerned about international law and many horrible wars in history, and leading to laws saying that between states, if they're going to behave in a certain way and that they will treat prisoners properly and they won't torture them and all that. And we know this is also in our headlines about Afghanistan, but we have an embarrassing little crisis that the United Nations, since it decided it was going to have ad hoc tribunals, has had a number of individuals convicted in former Yugoslavia and in Sierra Leone and in Tanzania, where they tried in the Rwandans. And when these people are convicted, then arises a new question of where will they be incarcerated? And really, we're getting some evidence that the thinking here wasn't very thorough and well-planned. The system so far seems to be based on, well, actually, I don't know what their criteria is, but if we start with the case of General Krstic, he is a Bosnian Serb, and he was convicted of crimes in that region. Now, he is 62 years old. He lost his leg in the fighting, one leg, and he was sent to a prison to do his time, 35 years, by the way, in Britain. And the prison, and so he's the lone United Nations prisoner being held in a British prison. It's very hard to know how would they work that out, because other prisoners, of course, are criminals, alleged criminals, certainly convicted, who are doing time for pretty nasty offenses. The prison is Wakefield Prison in Northern England, and it's has very hardened criminals. So there is this general, and people can say, well, he's a, you know, he was convicted of crimes against humanity, etc., so he must be really bad too. But, you know, there really has to be some kind of recognition of who we're dealing with or what we're dealing with. He's put in a prison with a tough criminals, and on May 7th, he was assaulted by three men, and his throat was cut, and he was stabbed, and he was beaten, and he was knocked unconscious during this process. And the question is, how in the world could this happen? And really, we're not getting any answers that I know of. It's certainly not the kind that we should be satisfied with. A number of people have been starting to talk about it and write about it, very much to their credit. Edward Herman his writing colleague, Mr. Peterson, I forget his first name, you may know.
Yeah, David Peterson.
Yeah, David Peterson. I probably didn't want to say it because I thought, David Peterson, it can't be right. That's the former Premier of Ontario. But no, you're right. It's David Peterson and Edward Herman. And then the writer Diana Johnston, who has written one of the better books on what occurred in the dismemberment of Yugoslavia. And they have are using this instance to say, you know, somebody has to, there has to be some oversight about how prisoners are treated. And I would argue for uniformity, there should be, actually, in my view, there should be one place, and it should be, and the United Nations has to take responsibility for this. They shouldn't be farming it out, a prisoner, to a state like the British state, because inevitably it takes on whatever the culture of the prisons in that particular country.
Yeah, the United Nations is supposed to be a supranational entity. It's supposed to be above countries and part of countries working together. Now, you'd think putting them in a British prison would have some kind of jurisdictional issues. I don't know. As you said, I don't know how this gets decided or what the process is.
You're right. Absolutely jurisdictional issues and actually, frankly, confusion over who's responsible. And when you don't, you know, when you begin to get vague as to who is ultimately answerable and to whom, bad things happen to individuals, and it resembles what people like to say happens in third world prisons. Although I think, by the way, now we're getting the idea that Canada, the United States, and Britain are not really any more virtuous than all the countries they like to look down their noses at. But at any rate, this is a terrible moment, and people should react to it and say, you know, we don't want anything to do with a process, whether it's called UN or not, that treats warehouses prisoners, treats them as though they are candidates for brutalization, which, by the way, is American prison culture. Judges sitting on benches often talk about how a prisoner might be face a different kind of justice, and they do that laughingly when about how they're going to send them off somewhere and they'll find out something. That means that we're all just slipping into a common culture with the people we claim, again, that was, you know, administering justice to. In my mind, this is linked to another individual people need to know about, and that is a Jean Bosco Berguiza, who was convicted by the tribunal in International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And his background, he was a middle-aged man, and he was trained in international law, worked in diplomatic functions for his government. He was found guilty at the tribunal and sentenced to life in prison. And so he was placed in Benin, a small African country, very different from his own, by the way, and particularly in terms of climate. Benin is an extremely hot place. And for about a year, I had been hearing that he wasn't well, and his family had been saying, please get him some proper treatment, and raising funds to pay for that treatment, but they were ignored. He remained right there, and has died. I'm very pained by that because I personally had encounters with him. He was a very affable, intelligent, well-spoken man. He spoke Russian, he spoke English, he spoke French, he spoke Kinyarwanda and Swahili, and it's just a terrible loss, and it's terrible that the way they defined the prison, the imprisonment of Jean Bosco Berguiza was, well, you know, what country would like to take this prisoner of the United Nations? And Benin said, we'll do it. And so they said, okay, well, you know, meet the specifications of a prison. So they put up some, you know, like a guy bidding for something. And they say, okay, well, now off he goes. And when he arrived there, the UN representative said to him, by the way, there were eight other Rwandans with him, they said, you are no longer our prisoners. Now you are prisoners of Benin, and Benin's job will be to hold you the rest of your life, and our function will be to provide financial contribution to Benin to cover your price as a prisoner. And inevitably, that leads to differentials in the kind of medical care, emergency services, facilities of all types. And the picture I've gotten of people who visited there is not so great. And people can laugh, and unfortunately, I think that's the subjective thing I'm addressing, is this attitude of our so-called civilization, our so-called legal institutions, and all founded on the concept of equality before the law and humane treatment, seems to go out the window once you call somebody a particular kind of criminal. If you say, oh, genocide, well, you know, so let him die.
Well, it sounds like oubliettes to me, you know, with the French.
Sounds like what, I'm sorry?
Like an oubliette, where like a forgetting prison. Like, I think the French kings, they had oubliettes, like in the films about the Count of Monte Cristo, that kind of thing, where they just put you away. And
the guys, you had those cartoons of them hanging by chains in basements.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly it's based on this alienation where we have decided they're beneath contempt, I guess, but this time these assumptions are being carried out by these institutions with label, you know, called the United Nations, which most people don't associate the United Nations with, you know, indifference, coldness, calculation, and all that.
It's very interesting. It sounds the way you're describing it, that getting put on a UN tribunal and being sent to prison for something, it's like it's a death sentence. So UN court is a death sentence.
Well, by the way, again, you're quite right about that. I mean, the other thing is that the United Nations is actually, of course, an abstract idea. It's a collection of states who've put in money, not all. The United States is famous for not putting in until it gets what it wants, and then it gives money. In other words, they just buy the place. But the real bosses are the Security Council members. There are five permanent, and they have staff and they have flags and they. But they, the idea that founded on some democratic principles is utter nonsense. I mean, the member states each have one kind of system or another, and one degree of respect for human rights and democratic notions or not, and then they put administrators and people with one kind of qualification or another in charge, and they're not answerable to the rest of us. We Canada would not even dare to ask a question. They don't want to get in trouble with it. Security Council, so they don't even ask. And the people who have this kind of discretionary power, middle-level bureaucrat, they're not afraid of anybody, except, well, I mean, their immediate boss who can fix them up or not, but they don't really, you have no national state or institution where they might actually come under scrutiny. You know, if they were in Canada, but like right now we're having this thing about torture. You know, you have Parliament and you have a Supreme Court. There's none of that at the United Nations. The United Nations didn't arrange any such thing. We don't have a world government, that's probably a good thing.
Well, I know what you're saying here. I mean, it's basically when someone gets arrested for some kind of crime that the United Nations is investigating, you assume there's going to be some kind of civilized process, a judicial process, in which they're going to be put in some kind of prison, and there'll be standards, and it'll be monitored, and they'll have appeals process, access to lawyers, there'll be, you know, contestation, there'll be cases, there'll be things being brought before boards and tribunals and continual discussion and with the media. But instead, these people are being thrown into a British worst offenders prison with dangerous people, or they're being in an underfunded prison in Benin or wherever,
then you say, well, now if we want to do something, where do you start? And the United Nations is quite remote from us. You know, who will investigate this? We don't know. Who's going to appoint these? Who made the decision, for example, to put him in Wakefield? Who was the genius that thought of that? The three men who attacked him, by the way, have been the British press have identified them as Muslims. This officer served in Bosnia. There was a fight involving Muslims. I just use the word genius as a joke, of course, because obviously somebody should have known that those prisoners were there. And that, you know, if I was supervising, I might call the guy and say, hey, remember who we have here, and don't let, you know, when he goes to lunch, don't have these other folks around.
Well, you know, as
your job when you're running. You know, when you're trying to run a prison and you're doing a conscientious job, you say, "Don't put this guy and the other one in the same cell block or whatever." Certainly, don't put them in. Be very careful, knowing that you might have a problem. But this seems really looks like one of those things where they said, "Here'd be a good joke. Let's this guy was, he murdered Muslims, so let's just put him in an area where they can get their hands on him.
Right. As you said, I mean, this is part of that culture of contempt, where the judges think it's funny. So if someone's accused of a particular crime, let's put them in that place where they're going to get them, and we can all have a laugh about it, and it's so funny.
They're
embracing the brutality that's inherent
in
the prison.
You know, epidemic rape in the U.S. prisons, it is a horrible problem, and it's, if you listen to America's comedians and judges and politicians, you can tell it's going on because they joke about it, or they think somehow it's just, in other words, the guy has it coming or something. And it's really, we ought to be worried about what's happening to us, that we tolerate that. I mean, a judge ought to be thrown off a bench if he ever made a remark about, you know, and judges have been known to say, I'm going to put you in a cell with a guy, you know. They actually say that.
Well, I mean, that's America for you, too, right? Yeah. On the one hand, they talk about freedom and all that, and then on the other hand, we know that there's a very big...
In the name of the law, I'm going to make sure a crime is committed against you.
Right.
Is what they basically are saying. So, yeah, so we shouldn't be surprised at Sarah Palin's and others, because they're really bubbling up this kind of backward culture, which forgets, you know, when it says law and order, they actually mean hit somebody with a stick.
Yes. And I can see this being translated to the international level. In the case you mentioned with the Bosnian general, with the 62-year-old man with one leg, it reminds me of also Milosevic. And this brings up the big danger to me, and that is these processes, these tribunals are so one-sided. So when they round up only one side of a civil war conflict and then put them on trial and then put them in jail, as you said, they're being put in horrendous conditions and being killed in prison or dying in prison. And so not only do you have selective prosecution, but then you have a sort of selective sentencing. You have a death sentencing for only some people. And that's what happened in Milosevic's case, because he was put on trial for a lot of things that we know were bogus now. And he was successfully defending himself in court.
Yes, at the risk of his health. And there were states that offered to give him care so that he could survive to go on. Or, by the way, you know, you're supposed to say, if it's determined that someone has a bad heart or whatever, actually, the legal tradition is don't proceed. If they're, you know, if they're incapacitated, you know, this great thirst for justice doesn't have to go forward. And you can just stop the process.
That's where it gets really interesting, because this is where, as an entity that goes above nation states, the United Nations can have it both ways. They can say we can be involved with every state we want to and put people in whatever prison in the world we want to, but we don't have to follow conventional rules about humane treatment of prisoners.
Yeah, and there is, it is not an organic system founded in undemocratic principles with courts and laws and a political institution that can be a kind of act as a buffer against excess. There actually isn't anything to prevent their movement of a prisoner from one place to another, and because it's ad hoc justice, that would be the tribunal, followed by ad hoc jailing. And it does, in my view, is that, and I think that we need some political scientists to think about this, but to me, it represents a kind of United Nations gulag, in that there isn't any one center. Their prisoners are sent to wherever they wish. Like there were prisoners, six individuals convicted of crimes against humanity at a UN tribunal in Sierra Leone, their home country. They are Sierra Leoneans. They've been transferred to do their time, life sentences, in Rwanda. So, and that's, you know, you scratch your head. What is going on here? These are, if you say he committed crime, killing his own people, etc., well, then just put him in a prison in his own country. Why does it? Do they end up in Rwanda? This is, it's, in my view, it kind of sounds like the old thing of people using the word Africa think they're describing every country. Africa is a continent, and depending on which country you're talking about, they're quite different from one another. Rwanda is very different than Sierra Leone, but also it walks all over the idea of justice being done and seen to be done, and you know where people remain in their own culture and whatnot. If you're a criminal in your own country and they you're convicted, you stay there, and that you become part of the national story, in a sense, good, bad, or indifferent. But anyway, then you have Mr. Jean-Bosco Berguiza, who dies, and when at this juncture, by the way, we don't even know what happened to him. Nobody's reporting on this. And then in Arusha, Tanzania, they had an Anglican bishop. I hope there are some Anglicans listening. He was a bishop. He had never gone to trial, and he died. And it just became a kind of bureaucratic thing. Well, strike his name off. Well, he was smeared, but he died an innocent man. Nobody ever showed he did anything. And now people are slowly realizing the government of Rwanda cannot be trusted. You know, when it labels people, it labeled him. But there have been a number of people acquitted, and there's also just history's catching up with the regime in Kigali. But that bishop, he died alone, inadequate care and terrible circumstances. And that's the way it was. There have been some at the former Yugoslavia, at The Hague, there was at least one, I think it was two, have died there, other than Milosevic. So, I don't think the UN actually meets the standards of ordinary states. And if it cannot rise to the standards of ordinary states, it ought to get out of the business altogether. Shouldn't have had these tribunals. Ramsey Clark and others have argued very eloquently that the United Nations wasn't set up to have tribunals. As Ramsey Clark says, if that had been put on the agenda, they would have voted it down.
Because
the U.S. and France and Britain decided they were going to force this idea through.
That's right, because, I mean, these are the people that are behind the trials. If you say, who's behind the trials?
Absolutely.
It is the United States, France, Britain, Canada sometimes, and so forth.
And, of course, it's all on the understanding that they would never be charged with
anything. No, well, they even said so, right? The U.S. tried to make it so that their people could never be charged,
yes.
Ever.
So, well, as a matter of fact, yes, when they set up the permanent tribunal, and I hope, again, your listeners notice how dizzying this is, the U.S. loves ad hoc tribunals, which they can just say, well, put one there and put it. But the permanent tribunal, the U.S. decided it didn't like that idea. And so it didn't even vote for it. And yet they have all this power over what does happen at the ad hoc tribunals. And they have signed bilateral agreements with states saying, we won't turn over your nationals to the permanent tribunal, and you won't turn over ours.
They're horse trading people.
Has a bilateral agreement with the United States is Sierra Leone.
Yeah, so they're just horse trading, and they're protecting each other. I think, as you said, there's this global or worldwide UN prison system of a sort, kind of like the way the U.S. has the secret torture prisons in so many countries around the world right now. And if you ask me, it's related to the way that the United States in particular is criminalizing opposition. So if you're acting in a manner that's contrary to their interests, especially if you're a head of state like Milosevic or part of the senior military apparatus, you're a criminal who's beyond any sort of rights. You're beyond human.
Well, that was the function of Louise Arbour and the accusation. You're quite right. Before the bombing, she says, oh, he's a criminal. You can't talk to him. I mean, what does she know about any of that? I mean, but they... And the Canadian government loved it, that, a Canadian judge had become the prosecutor. But here was a peace process going on, and she says, oh, no, you can't talk to him, you see. I'm labeling him a criminal. So your peace process is knocked down like a practical joke. And they did this, of course, also with the present government of Sudan, but except that they weren't successful. I think the game is getting a little old with a lot of countries who are showing more and more resistance to this particularly outrageous approach, which is every political leader that crosses France, Britain, the United States gets labeled, and they try to take him off the table. He can't function as the leader of his country.
Well, It looks like we are running out of time for today, but yes, thanks for bringing this to our attention. I mean, we've talked about how there is a very one-sided approach to these tribunals, how there's, as we know, there's a core of countries behind the tribunals, and we've talked about how only certain groups are put into the tribunal process. They focused on Bosnian Serbs rather than other groups, and in Africa, in various countries within Africa, it's a similar case. But now when it comes to prosecution and imprisonment of those people, the continuing low standards of justice apply, and I think that's disturbing.
Well, yeah, I hope that people will look it up. I think all you have to do is just write General Krstic, K-R-S-T-I-C, and get the background, and then start doing things like calling on members of the bar here and the Canadian government and members of parliament and say, why are we involved with a UN that permits a prisoner, our prisoner, to be assaulted? We have to, you know, be engaged in guaranteeing security of our prisoners. One of the first things you're supposed to learn if you...
Well, we haven't been so good at that when you think about what's been happening in Afghanistan. I think Canada, the Canadian government needs to recognize that I think citizens here desire that our standards of justice apply in Canada and outside of Canada. As long as we're involved, we would like to see a procedure followed, and we'd like to make sure that some kind of standards apply.
Yeah, speak up for the general. General Kirsten, he ought to be protected. And make sure that not just the guys who assaulted him, but whoever had responsibility for ensuring that he was in a prison and secure and treated humanely, they ought to be fired.
Well, everyone has a right to a trial. Everyone has a right to fair treatment, and we shouldn't throw that away.
And they have a right to humane treatment, no matter even if they're the worst so-called criminals you got. They have a right to be safe in their person. After all, we didn't sentence them to be tortured. We sentence them to remain in a prison, not to be beaten up.
That's right. This is a way of getting around the sentence.
By the way, let's remember that we had a Rwandan arrested here, and they put him on trial for crimes against humanity in Montreal. And the first thing that happened to him was that he was hit with an iron chair in a cell in Montreal. He was nearly killed.
So I guess they think that
we
prisoners...
We should look into our own hearts and say, what's the matter with us?
They're thinking that the prisoners are going to deliver justice, like some of these.
Well, they're inviting them to. You know, you put a lurid headline about, oh, this serious bad man, and then you put him in a cell with somebody who's already got his own problems and is violent, and he'll act out. And then everybody, you know, he becomes the agent of who we are. And I have to say that when he hit that guy with the chair, he was acting out with the editors of Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail. They all contributed to an atmosphere which made it the most natural thing for him to haul off and hit him.
I think that's some insight that a lot of people don't necessarily want to think about at first. And once we point it out, I think I'm glad you're making these connections. Well, I guess that's it for now. I want to thank you again for bringing that to our attention. We hadn't really talked about the results of the prison process that much, the UN prison process, except in the case of Milosevic. So,
we'll do more, I hope.
Well, I appreciate that. So, Phil, thanks for taking the time to be with us this week.
My pleasure.